Welcome to Early Returns, hosted by Jan Baron, a partner of Holtzman Vogel. This podcast examines law and politics and seeks insights from political players in elections, lobbying, media, and the law. Now, let's join our host, Jan Baron.
Welcome back to Early Returns, a podcast about law and politics. I'm your host, Jan Baron. Our producer is Jody Mayer Piazza. We're at the beginning of a new election cycle, as well as a new session of Congress. That means that election campaigns and lobbying are getting into high gear. And listeners of Early Returns know that political activity and lobbying have become not only full-time activities, but also highly regulated. If you're thinking of getting into politics or lobbying the government, you better know what the rules are. And you might even need a lawyer to help you. Today, to talk about the methods, demands, and challenges of advising clients on political law, I'm fortunate to have as my guest, Wesley Bizzell. Wes is a lawyer who has spent over 20 years specializing in political law. For most of his career, Wes has worked for Altria Corporation, which is one of the world's largest tobacco companies. Altria is politically active and lobbies both Congress and state legislatures. Wes currently is the Senior Assistant General Counsel and Managing Director of Political Law and Ethics Programs at Altria. So he basically supervises compliance by that company with all these laws. In addition, Wes Bizzell is active in promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion within the legal and corporate communities. He serves on several boards and commissions and is the immediate past president of the National LGBTQ Bar Association. Thank you for coming to Early Returns and welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me, Jan.
Well, to get us started, why don't you tell our listeners a little more about yourself, where you grew up, and how you became an expert in political law?
Certainly. So I grew up in Arkansas and moved to Washington, D.C. for college and stayed there after college to go to law school and did a master's degree there as well, and was in D.C. for almost 30 years before I moved out to California a few years ago. I think like most political law practitioners, it wasn't on my radar when I went into law school. I had worked on Capitol Hill, so I knew what it was. And I knew the then restrictions that existed on Capitol Hill, which have increased in intensity certainly since then, including the Lobbying Disclosure Act. So that tells you sort of when I was on Capitol Hill. So after law school, I went into a large law firm, Winston & Strawn in Washington, D.C., where my focus was primarily government relations issues, doing direct lobbying for our clients. And one day early in my career, during my first year, quite frankly, of practice, one of the partners came up and a client wanted to start a PAC, a political action committee. And so no one else in my group wanted to sort of do that work. So I became, you know, sort of the go-to person for that, not only for our practice group, but for all of the firm's clients. So other clients outside of the practice group, some of our litigation clients or our corporate clients that had political law issues, they would always be directed my way. So, you know, I was involved in a New York Stock Exchange investigation, for instance, that we were doing other work for, creating PACs, providing just general legalized advice. It was really something that I fell into, but it was something that sort of married my interest in politics with my interest in the law and in sort of procedure and compliance in general. And so it was a great combination. And so after about 7 years, I moved into practice at Altria, which was one of my clients.
Altria is obviously in need of a lot of legal support, particularly in this area, in large part because it's not only a big corporation, but it's in a controversial line of business, not only public controversy, but a lot of legal issues. What was your thinking about transitioning from law firm to a company that was in the tobacco products industry? Any blowback or hesitancy on any of that?
Well, like I said, I mean, they were one of my clients. I wasn't doing political law work for them. Actually, I was doing legislative work for them and had come into contact with them through that. And so I was helping the Winston & Strawn team lobby for passage of the Tobacco Control Act, which gave FDA the authority to regulate tobacco, which was something that Altria was in support of and was the only cigarette company supporting that legislation. So I was familiar with the organization. I wasn't familiar with its political law work, quite honestly. But what really attracted me to the company was its very strong commitment to responsibility. And I think there was a time that came to a point in the late 90s where Altria and her predecessor company became out of line with societal expectations. And we really took a step back and looked at how to become in alignment. We came very close to losing our license to operate. And so that, I think, really created an environment by the time I joined about 10 years later that compliance and responsibility and behaving ethically in the space and behaving within the societal expectations was really paramount to what we were doing. And that was what really impressed me the most. And the fact that certainly in 2007, when I joined the company, we were one of the few companies to have a dedicated in-house political law attorney supervising this work and essentially serving as the chief compliance officer for this type of work. And the resources that we provided and dedicated to being both legally and reputationally in compliance was impressive and was an opportunity that I couldn't resist.
Well, was there anything in place when you arrived? Were you succeeding somebody in this role, or were you basically put in the position of starting a whole compliance program from scratch?
I would say our compliance program was in its infancy when I joined. I did succeed someone who came in to the program and who started the program. And we've certainly since evolved and changed over the last 16 years now that I've been with the company, as our businesses have changed, as the legal requirements have changed, as societal expectations of how one behaves in this space and what one discloses to the public, quite frankly, has really altered the compliance program. And so I've been able to evolve it, to leverage technology to a large degree, to really take away the pain points. Very few people appreciate a lawyer saying, you know, I'm here to provide you compliance advice. And so coming into the program, my desire was to, you know, make sure we were behaving legally and ethically, but do it in a way that made my clients, my internal clients, their lives as easy as possible. And certainly having been a lobbyist, both at the federal level, worked on Capitol Hill and done some state lobbying work as well, I knew sort of where those pain points were. And I could talk the lingo of a lobbyist and understand where they were coming from as I'm crafting or recrafting the program that we have.
How many employees would be involved in the political and lobbying activities of Altria? Obviously, it's not everybody. The company has 6,000 or plus employees. I mean, are you dealing with everybody at the company, or is it basically focused on what I would call the usual suspects, the folks who are likely, because of their job description, be interacting with politicians and with government officials?
So it's a little bit of both. So certainly we have, for a company, a fairly large government affairs organization. Those are certainly my primary clients. As you mentioned, we have both a federal lobbying presence and we have lobbyists in every state. We have several hundred consultant lobbyists in all the states as well. And so that's where the bulk of the work generates, of course, but there are other aspects of the company that deal with government officials. And so the program touches those individuals as well.
Just to be clear for our listeners, I mean, when talking about political law, we're basically focusing on the laws that regulate campaigns and lobbying. And those would be campaign finance laws. They would be lobbying disclosure laws. And also the growing number of laws that regulate social interaction and gifts to government officials. When can you take somebody out to dinner and issues like that? Am I missing any other sort of intersection with this activity, legal basis of law that comes within your jurisdiction?
That's right. I mean, those are really the three primary issue areas that arise.
What would be the elements of the program at Altria to ensure oversight, compliance, reporting, and things of that nature?
It is a comprehensive compliance program that covers federal, state, local, international activities that we have, like you said, in the lobbying, campaign finance, and government ethics space. It is a separate program from our general compliance program, or what companies generally have the HR compliance program. I serve both as the lawyer and essentially this chief compliance officer, the program person for the political law and ethics compliance program. And so it is both pre-approval and post-approval. It's activities. It is providing advice on lobbying registrations and filings. It is providing oversight of those activities. And one of the things that I first worked on when I came, and something that I'm very proud of that we continue to be a leader in, is in the area of transparency of political activities and disclosures. And so we provide a lot of information on our website regarding our work in the space and how we oversee and what our compliance processes are for this work. In fact, last year, we released what I think is a first of its kind report that we call our Lobbying and Political Activity Integrity and Transparency Report that provides really a comprehensive narrative that looks at our policy issues we engage on, the primary policy issues we engage on, the oversight and compliance processes that we have, our engagement with third parties, our lobbying expenditures, and our political contributions.
Are there training programs that are mandatory? How would they look like, and how often people have to certify that they paid attention to these rules?
Yes, so there definitely are training components. So each year I do trainings for, you know, as you mentioned, the primary suspects, the folks who have direct responsibility in the government affairs space, both at federal level and the state levels. So we have, you know, a number of employees who divvy the states up amongst each other and have responsibility for each of the 50 states plus the territories. And then I also provide yearly training for our outside consultants, the external lobbyists that we hire as well. And then there's a generalized training component for all employees, because employees throughout the organization can stumble into this space if they don't realize that there are restrictions or are issues. You've seen a number of companies where their employee thought they were buying a table to a charity event, put it on their corporate credit card, and it was actually going to fundraise for a political action committee or some other type of political event.
Altria has a PAC, a political action committee you mentioned, and that, of course, has to file reports with government agencies. Does it use a PAC to make political contributions to both federal candidates as well as state candidates? And separately, does Altria make campaign contributions from corporate money in states where that is legal?
So yes to both. So we do have a federal PAC that makes primarily contributions to candidates running for the U.S. House or U.S. Senate. We also make contributions to a handful of states that allow for PAC contributions but prohibit corporate contributions. And then we do make corporate contributions in those jurisdictions where that is permitted. There's a handful of states. I think we don't make contributions in 5 states where it is impractical, essentially, based on the state laws, to operate a federal PAC within those jurisdictions. We are definitely active in the political sphere in almost every state.
In addition to all that activity, I know from your bio, which we've posted on our website, that has more details about all of your professional activities. Altria is very conscious about diversity, equity, and inclusion. It has a gay rights organization. I believe that you're either the head of, and certainly very prominent in that. How did that evolve institutionally at the company?
That's a great question. And so we have an employee resource group, or what's often known as an ERG, for LGBTQ plus individuals. That organization, our ERG, turns 10 this year. I was one of the founders of it and the incoming chair for it for 2023. It was something, you know, that I'm happy that we did. We were a little late to the game, quite frankly, compared to other Fortune 500 companies in this space, but have really made some tremendous progress in the diversity, equity, inclusion space since then. And so I think we have over a dozen employee resource groups now that, you know, range from Asian American Pacific Islanders, Black Americans, to people with disabilities, to experienced hires. And we have a women in manufacturing, a women in sales organization as well. And so those really allow employees to help change the organization, to have a way to drive change within the organization, to elevate issues that might be pain points for people within the organization. And so through my work with Mosaic, we've helped change policies. We've helped get the company involved in charitable organizations that deal with LGBTQ plus issues. We've also taken a stand on LGBTQ plus equality issues.
And in addition to what you've done at Altria, you've been proactive on these issues outside of the company, presumably outside of your usual professional responsibilities there. As I mentioned in my introduction, you are the immediate past president of the LGBTQ plus Bar Association, the National Bar Association. I have to admit, until you became president, Wes, I was not familiar with that Bar Association. And of course, you and I go back many years. So it was something that I was quite interested in learning about. Basically, I don't know when it started and how you wound up being the president.
Sure. I'm happy to tell you the story. I actually love the sort of the origin story of the National LGBTQ Plus Bar Association. So in 1987, there was the second lesbian and gay march on Washington. And a group of lawyers came together during that march and met and decided that it was necessary to have a national affinity bar for LGBTQ plus lawyers. There were a number of city-based LGBTQ plus bar associations. Interestingly, none of them used the word lesbian or gay, or certainly not bisexual or transgender or queer in their title. There was one in here in San Francisco called the Bay Area Lawyers for Individual Freedoms, for example. And so they were more under the radar, which makes sense for the 1980s during this time. But these were primarily a group of solo practitioners who were operating in the family law and trust and estates areas of practice, and who at the time in the 1980s were doing a lot of pro bono work, helping young, primarily gay men who were diagnosed with AIDS and had a short lifespan ahead of them and were dying during the AIDS crisis. And so these group of lawyers came together, realized there was a need to have a legal advocacy organization and a legal organization dedicated to LGBTQ plus lawyers. And so we held our first conference, what we call our Lavender Law Conference and Career Fair now, the next year in 1988 in San Francisco. In 1992, we became an official affiliate of the American Bar Association, and we are primarily known for our Lavender Law Conference and Career Fair, which is the largest LGBTQ plus legal conference, and it is the largest legal career fair of its type. So much has changed since our organization was founded in 1987. We now have all of the Am Law 100 firms recruiting at our conference. That was not happening, of course, in 1987. And the reason why the organization was founded by people who were solo practitioners primarily is because openly gay lawyers weren't being hired by large law firms. And if you were LGBTQ plus at a large law firm, you were almost always in the closet. So we have certainly changed and morphed over time. Our focus area is helping law students who are LGBTQ plus, all the way through lawyers who are experienced in their careers.
Does the association have an office? Does it have staff? If so, where are they? Also, how many members are there of the association?
We do have paid staff based in Washington, D.C. During my two-year term as president, we significantly expanded the staff that we have. And so we aim to represent all LGBTQ plus lawyers, no matter what their practice is, no matter where they practice in government or in nonprofits or in corporations or in law firms of whatever size. And so we generally bring in about 2,000 people to our conference every year. And our membership is certainly over that. But we're really happy to continue to see the legal community sort of embracing LGBTQ plus equality issues. And we work with corporations and law firms to do trainings, to help with recruitment, and to help them be a place that retains and attracts LGBTQ plus talent.
I gather that the Bar Association does not have a political action committee. It doesn't get involved in making political contributions, but it does engage in lobbying and public advocacy on these issues.
That is correct. We do not have a political action committee, but we do have a couple of core issues that we feel we are particularly well suited to engage on. One of them is the LGBTQ plus panic defense, which essentially is a legal tactic that's designed to play into longstanding prejudices against the LGBTQ plus community that allows people who assault or and oftentimes murder an LGBTQ plus victim to claim that it was the sudden revelation of the LGBTQ plus person's identity that provoked them or caused them to commit the crime. That unfortunately continues to be a problem to this day. We started on this issue in the about 2010 and in 2013 convinced the American Bar Association's House of Delegates to adopt a policy calling for the ban of the panic defense. And since then, we have successfully worked to have 17 states adopt the ban. And during my term as president, and even today, I'm still highly involved in that activity where we testify before various state judiciary committees on the topic, work with the proponents and the sponsors of the legislation to help get these bans passed.
And what other issues does the Bar Association have on its priority list for advocacy?
The other priority issue that we have is what we call the Juror Non-Discrimination Act. And so it would prohibit jurors from being discriminated against because of their sexual orientation or gender identity.
Does the Bar Association have a position with respect to these issues that keep coming up to the Supreme Court about First Amendment and artistic rights of certain commercial sellers of wedding cakes and florists and things of that sort, and whether they can discriminate among their customers for being LGBTQ?
We do. We actually have a program where we do submit amicus briefs to the Supreme Court on these issues. We certainly feel like exceptions to non-discrimination laws are very problematic and create a very large loophole and deny protections to LGBTQ plus individuals. And so we are supportive of comprehensive non-discrimination laws. We do coordinate with the other LGBTQ plus civil rights organizations on these types of issues as well.
In your work for Altria, especially in their political contribution activities, they support candidates of all sorts, I assume. Do they evaluate a candidate's position on social policy and on any of these issues that you are active in with respect to LGBTQ plus bar priorities? Has there ever been a tension in your experience between what your client is doing and maybe your position on the same issue?
I will say that we have a very sort of robust review process for our political contributions that not only looks at the legality issues that sort of fall within my purview, but also looks at whether and where these individual candidates align with our own internal both policy priorities and corporate values. And so we do look at these issues. I think like any company, we don't agree 100% with any individual candidate. In my view, that's very similar to how each of us individually operate as voters. We are never going to align perfectly with a candidate that we decide to vote for, but we weigh everything in the balance and determine whether to support a candidate or not. So certainly their views on how they align with our diversity, equity, inclusion beliefs is part of that mix.
The role of corporations in politics and in America in general is changing quite a bit. It used to be back in the 1950s, of course, the president of General Motors said whatever is good for General Motors is good for America, as long as they could make cars and make profits and distribute dividends to their shareholders and so forth. Obviously, that is changing extensively in the last few years in terms of what is the proper role of corporations. Should they have a greater role in cultural and social issues, the environment, the so-called ESG debate, environment, social governance, seems to be popping up quite a bit in two areas. One is when companies have a PAC and they're deciding whether to support certain candidates, as you say, can't agree with everybody on everything. You know, so these candidates could have different positions on LGBTQ issues, on abortion, on their environmental positions, and so on. And then it's coming up in terms of their lobbying and their just public posture. And I think the most notable instance in the last year and a half or so was down in Florida, and when the legislature had legislation that was banning instruction in certain elementary grades about sex and gender, the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, the Disney company decided that was something they needed to say publicly, in part because they were responding to what their employees were saying and were urging the company to do. What's your view on what's going on here? Are the changes that big? Are they happening that quickly? Is there now a sort of reaction to instances like the Disney episode in Florida? What do you have, if any, predictions on how that's going to continue going forward? It's going to be reflected in all companies, large public companies, and certainly it seems something that would be of importance and discussion at a company like Altria, which already has had to increase its social sensitivity for a variety of reasons because of the industry that it's in.
I think you're right. I think the environment is challenging for companies that wish to engage in social policy type issues and take stands that align with their stated corporate values. We've seen that ebb and flow since the 1980s. So if you look at companies that were anti-apartheid and taking stands on apartheid and sort of the backlash that they may have received at that time, what the driver is two things. So one is a increasingly declining trust in government. So people's trust in government, if you look at surveys, is going down and continues to go down. And so many people are looking to companies to sort of step in and try to help solve social problems. That is partly, I think, a generational issue. So as younger employees, millennials and Gen X employees come into the workforce or in the workforce, they have very defined views on what a company should and should not be doing. And so they sort of reject that view from the GM CEO that all you have to do is worry about profit, that they want corporate good to be social good. So that's one thing that's driving it. But also the other thing on the opposite end of the spectrum is the political polarization that we see in today. And so companies are oftentimes caught in the middle. So their employees want them to take action. Some of their investors do, some of their investors don't. As you mentioned, you're seeing an increasing number of politicians who are taking aim at companies that do. Disney was certainly not the first. Delta Airlines felt it in Georgia a few years prior to that as well, where the legislature attempted to take away some tax breaks that that company had on aviation fuel. So it really requires a company to be thoughtful as they engage in this space. I'm pleased that Altria has continued to take stands that are in line with our corporate values on a wide variety of issues. So we are a company that's based and headquartered in Richmond, Virginia. And so our CEO came out in support of the removal of the Confederate monuments, for instance, that existed in our home city. We have supported and lobbied in favor of LGBTQ plus equality issues. But I think what it requires is that a company can't just sort of jump into this without ensuring that its own actions are aligned with what they're asking others to do, number one. And they have to be thoughtful and strategic about how they engage. I mean, clearly, I am a realist. And while I think it would be great if any company weighs in on these issues, these issues are occurring in 50 plus jurisdictions, right? They're the 50 states, the US Congress, localities as well. And so a company can't always engage on, from a lobbying perspective, on in support of or against a particular social policy issue. They've got to look to see where their influence is, where they can have a role to play in the conversation. And that's going to vary company by company. And so I think from the LGBTQ plus perspective, I will say that I don't think we would be where we are today in terms of LGBTQ plus equality issues had it not been for companies internally doing the right thing, starting in the 1990s, where they were providing anti-discrimination provisions within their corporate policies, where they were providing benefits for domestic partners. And so those types of issues, I think, helped change the conversation and help push government to act, and as we've seen in the past. But it is a difficult issue, and it's something that I think, having helped Altria sort of develop the criteria that we look at to engage on social issues, it requires some type of thoughtful criteria. It requires a mix of people. This is not just something that the government affairs shop should be responsible for. You need different inputs. You need sort of a collaborative team effort. So we have, for instance, on when we discuss social policy issues, we have our HR folks, our diversity and inclusion folks, our corporate responsibility folks, our communication folks. So it is a cross-collaborative team that we then make recommendations to our executives on whether or not to engage on an issue that comes before us. So my prediction is that it's going to continue to not be easy for companies, and they have to make sure that they're not just talking the talk, but walking the walk before they engage on these types of issues.
Do you think that what Disney decided to do was a mistake? And if so, what were the mistakes?
I think Disney, not knowing what happened internally, but looking at it from the outside, it appeared that Disney was caught a little flat-footed on the issue and then reacted only and took a position only when their employees raised some consternation about the lack of activity of the company. And so jumping in at the last minute, as you know, in a policy battle is rarely successful to begin with. And so acting earlier could have been helpful, and looking at other ways to influence. So sometimes it is, you know, the company speaking in its own voice. Sometimes it's joining together with others to speak out on an issue. Sometimes it's working through trade groups or other membership organizations that they may be involved in. And then sometimes, I think we don't see this as much these days, but I think it's something that could be very beneficial, is giving the employees their own platform to speak in their own voice. So making it easier for employees to communicate with their own elected officials. Companies do this on the grassroots perspective on sort of business-oriented matters, but very few companies provide that opportunity for employees to speak out on social policy issues. So I think looking at the array of options that Disney had, I would say they got involved late and they didn't sort of utilize the best options that they could have.
Well, based on the public reports, it sounds like they didn't do what you had just suggested is really important if a company is going to get involved in any sort of public issue, which is you've got to have your internal team together. You've got to have your government affairs folks. You got to have your communications folks. Yes, the HR folks. And the public reports suggest not only that Disney got in late, but their government affairs folks didn't seem to know what was going on and lay the groundwork. The communications department was challenged in terms of what they were going to be communicating internally as well as externally. And of course, HR, I don't know what was going on there in terms of the dynamics at a company like that with respect to employee communications and activity. It seems to be a case study as to not getting into an important public social issue, but a case study as to how to do it the wrong way and whether to do it in that particular situation.
I think that's right. I mean, sometimes process is half the battle. And so understanding the process and being thoughtful about the process before sort of jumping into action, I think it was necessary in this step. And I think because of internal pressure, Disney, I assume that they have an internal process because they do engage on these issues with somewhat regularity. But it seemed like it might have been short-circuited during this event based on sort of employee dissatisfaction.
Well, you mentioned that you spent about 30 years in Washington, but we're talking today, I'm still in Washington, but you're in San Francisco in the Bay Area. How long ago did you move and what precipitated that?
So we moved out here in 2019. And so out of having been in Washington for almost 30 years, it was a time for a change. And so I still love DC. I have a physical office still in DC with Altria, but wanted to get outside of that Beltway bubble a little bit. And also we have a son who turns 18 in a few days, but was then entering high school. And so wanted to give him a different high school experience. And, you know, I think looking at how sort of East Coast Washington educates students and the little more sort of entrepreneurial bent that the Bay Area has, wanted to sort of expose him to that. And so the benefit of all that was when the world shut down in March of 2020, I was already working remotely, was not as rough of a transition as some of my colleagues experienced. I was already into sort of the routine of working remotely and was able to not have sort of the disruption that others experienced when COVID hit.
Does your job and your activities require you to travel quite a bit? Or are you able to do this remotely?
I do travel a fair amount, specifically related still with the LGBTQ plus Bar Association and some diversity work that I do. But I get back to Washington usually a couple times a quarter now. But the bulk of my work certainly is remote. Most of my clients are scattered throughout the entire country, although a lot of the government affairs folks are in our DC office, but not all of them. About half of them are elsewhere. So I was already, like any lawyer, you're used to working with clients who are not in the same room as you. And so that was sort of always part of my ethos and how I constructed my work.
With your travel and with your remote work and living in the San Francisco Bay Area, I assume you get some time to read books. One of the things I always enjoy asking my guests is, do you have such time? And number two, do you have any book recommendations for our listeners?
I do. I love to read. It was something that certainly dates back to my elementary school years, where I remember specifically my third grade teacher, you know, I was given some dispensation to like every 2 days to go to the library and get a new book because I was a voracious reader at that point. I don't do that as much these days, but I do have some book recommendations. Two that I read last year. One, Walking with the Wind by John Lewis, which is his autobiography. I have always been in awe of Congressman Lewis, have had the privilege of interacting with him on a number of occasions and going on the Faith and Politics Congressional Civil Rights Pilgrimage with him a number of years ago that went to Alabama, looking at having gone to, you know, Montgomery, and one of certainly the most impactful moments of my life, and one that I will never forget, is standing on the Edmund Pettus Bridge with Congressman Lewis and a couple of hundred other people, including dozens of members of Congress, and having him recount the story of Bloody Sunday. So he has long been an inspiration, and it is an intriguing book about both his young life and certainly his work in the civil rights movement and throughout Congress. And then the second one is a new book that was written and released in 2022 called The Secret City by James Kirchick. It's really a riveting history of LGBTQ plus life in Washington, D.C. through politics. So it looks at, it breaks it up by presidential administration, starting with FDR, looks at political figures who were LGBTQ plus or who had children who were LGBTQ plus or who were accused of being LGBTQ plus, and sort of both the struggles of the LGBTQ plus civil rights movement during that time and sort of the individual ramifications. Because certainly starting in the 30s, even through the 90s, at least in some cases, even today, even the suggestion of being gay destroyed a reputation, ended a career, ruined lives, and even led to suicide by those who were accused of being gay. There were a lot of stories, having lived in Washington for a long time and having been involved in the LGBTQ plus rights movement, there were a lot of stories that even I didn't realize. A U.S. senator who committed suicide in his Capitol Hill office because his opponents were going to reveal that his son was gay. And the only suicide of a U.S. senator that has still occurred. And so, you know, it's a deep look. It's a fantastically well-researched book that looks at both the hypocrisy of what was going on and sort of the pain that occurred both societally and individually to people during this time.
Well, I've been in Washington since, over 50 years. So it's been a while. I can attest just from my own observations how dramatically things have changed and how really the LGBTQ situation has improved in my lifetime. It's incredible.
It really is.
What it was like when I got here was incredible now in retrospect, but the advances are just incredible. So The Secret City is the second recommendation. Walking with the Wind is the first for your library. I want to thank you, Wes Bazell, for those reading suggestions and for your time and insights on law and politics. Thanks also to our producer, Jody Mayer, Piazza. Enjoy listening to all our episodes on Spotify, Apple, Google, or your favorite podcast streaming platform. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join me on the next episode of Early Returns.
Thanks for joining Early Returns, Law and Politics with Jan Behrend. We hope you will join us for future episodes, which will continue to bring you voices and insights from the people engaged in our political landscape.